Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Liquid Books. We're joined in the studio today by a very special friend and educator, Joe Circatella. Hello, Joe.
Hello, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. You are the founder and principal of a school in Budapest. Can you tell us about that work?
Well, not exactly the founder, but the school has been here since for 16 years, and it's an international Christian school. We have many diplomats and over 31 different nationalities represented, 10 different religions. So we're an American full school, like K through 12.
And then our topic today is one which you've had done a great deal of thinking about, which is moral education in children. That's a pretty big topic. Is there any way to understand what is the substance of moral education? Are we talking about religious education, ethics, or what?
Well, we have to define some terms, obviously. I'm dealing with many different cultures. There's many different mores, if you will. The basis is thinking. We have a school. We want people to think. I have a little antidote that I give one of my college classes that 5% of the people in the world think, 10% of the people of the world think that they think, and 85% of the people of the world would rather die than think. And I think that's true. I think it's a lost art. We try to teach our students to ask good questions. I have a quote from Peter Drucker. Can't find it right now. But he says it's not so important about the answers all the time. We need to teach our students and ourselves to ask the right questions. And that's what your listeners here are trusting you to do. People come in and they tune in their computer or their radio, and they're trusting that you handle these interviews or whatever and ask the right questions, because it would be a waste of time if we got the wrong questions and superfluous answers.
So then it sounds like you're putting morality in the context of basic common sense, getting people's brains working and independently investigating truth and being responsible for themselves. Are there any tools in education for doing that?
Well, we're fighting a battle, I believe. I believe there's certain myths in the world today. Foremost, I would say the relativity of moral values. Right now, this relativity has caused chaos and confusion. What is right? What is wrong? What is good? What is bad? It used to be certain things were known as evil, and now they are good. Certain things that were good are now called evil. This needs to be defined in the schools at a young age. I had a professor, a friend of mine who teaches in the Cal system, UCal system, University of California system, and he thinks it's a joke that they are teaching ethics to juniors and seniors in university. He says it's a little late to be teaching ethics and morality. This is why we have problems with Enron and Tyco and Global Crossings and these other. If we are doing nothing but educating people, just pouring into them facts and figures, then we will get what we have seen. We get educated criminals, in my mind. We are tasked with the whole student, body, mind, and soul. And it doesn't do any good if they just have facts. We need to have some kind of foundation built on something that everyone can agree on, which is right and wrong, and that there are absolutes. And many times in education today, our students are told that there is nothing absolute. Whatever feels good, do it, which is a dangerous thing.
This raises a couple of questions then. Let me ask the easier one, relatively easier one first. Namely, are you suggesting that teaching ethics is a qualitatively different process from other kinds of teaching? And if so, does it require different techniques, different kinds of testing, or ensuring that students have acquired these qualities, and so on?
You said that was the easy
question? That's the easier one, yeah.
I'm leaving.
Stay a while.
that's, Well, we know that people learn differently. Also, we know there's six or seven different ways people obtain knowledge. There's music people, there's touchy people, there's listening people, there's seeing people, and it's always been an interesting thing of how to assess what they know. But with morality, I don't know if you can give a grade on it. I read an article I shared with you a little while ago that a young lady was very distraught because she was in an ethics class in college, and the best student in the class was cheating his way through the ethics class. I teach in every semester I teach one class in a Bible college here in Budapest, and I was amazed that the first time I proctored a test, people were cheating. And I just looked at them like, how can you cheat in a Bible test? Does it make any sense to you? So how would you measure? I think you have life, you put life situations with children, and it's maybe not a class as much as an environment of the school, and that everyone is attuned to it, and everyone has the same basic foundational beliefs of what is right and wrong and good and bad throughout the school from the morning to the end. And it helps if the parents are in on it too.
Do you have a sense that in doing such teaching you're acting as a proxy for parents and that parents need to take more responsibility for that?
There's a Latin term, in loco parentis, which means with the parents, working with the parents. We are very very aware that we are privileged that the parents give us their children for 7, 8, 9 hours a day from the morning until evening, and that is our responsibility, and that it's also our belief that it's really the parents' position. They are to raise their children, and they are it is their responsibility to educate their children. Now, they allow us to help in that, and we should work with them. We've had problems, I know, back in the United States where we've had parents are not welcome sometimes at the table to get involved in school boards, that the educators said, no, we know better. I don't know if that's worked so far. If you looked at education back for the last 40 years, America is in the last global standardized tests is down 18th or 19th of the industrialized world. I don't know if that's good.
Do you perceive over time certain things which convince you that moral education produces results of a concrete kind? Do you see the kids moving into life situations? You've been at this for some time now, where there is any indication that it pays off?
Well, they see that there's a distinct difference between them and other students when they leave us and they go to university. Most of our students go to American universities, and usually within a month or two I get some emails. Thank goodness for emails. It's amazing how it has linked us. And we get immediate feedback on what's going on. It's even affected the way we do some curriculum, because we know what they're expected to have been prepared for at university, and we can change things. But yes, they come back and they tell us situations that they've been put in and that we have made them aware of, that we prepared them for what to look out for. And just if they're aware of the situations and that there is right and wrong, and they don't have to go with their emotions all the time. Your emotions can lie to you. Your feelings can lie to you. But if you have some kind of moral compass and some kind of conviction that, no, this is wrong and this is always wrong and that everything is not relative, they're very happy people. I have parents come to me often and say, we want to thank you. You have a good school, which is very nice to hear, but you have given us a whole child. Sometimes a parent will tell me, you know, I visit other people and they have SAT scores of 2350 and 2400. This is the highest you can get in the SATs. And my son is almost there, but not totally there. But you know what? I can talk to my son. He actually has the ability to convey thoughts and has an idea of just relationships, and which sometimes you don't always have.
I have a nephew in the States who just underwent long-term therapy for an addiction that he fell into, and that's exactly the language that my sister is using in talking about him, that we have our child back, you know, it's that he's our son again, and so it's that kind of experience of a child being equipped to be able to maintain his or her integrity, his or her existence, identity, and so on in the face of things that are kind of out there, which are threats to that. Is that your perception of the value of moral education? It's a kind of armor in the face of societal threats?
Sure. It's like we send our students, our elementary students, to swimming classes every week. I call it waterproofing. We are waterproofing them so when they get thrown in the water, they can actually swim. Here, we're throwing the kids into the world, and we're trying to prepare them with some kind of foundation. Because if they don't have anything, then it's just purely their preference and how they feel. And your feelings can lie to you. You can be sincere, but you could be sincerely wrong, right? Because of your feelings. These can lie, but if you have a certain foundation, you're a happier person. It's like our kids with discipline. We don't have such serious discipline at our school, but our kids do have a schedule and a discipline, and they thrive in it because you cannot teach with chaos and anarchy in the classrooms.
What is the relation then between moral education and religious education? Is there a clear line that can be drawn between those?
Well, I remember in cultural anthropology classes, we were told that all cultures were derived from religion. So I would think that morality derives from some kind of belief system, some kind of faith system. People must believe in something. Lately, I think too much so, people are believing in themselves. I am a Christian. I am a Christian educator. We believe basically that man is a fallen creature. Man starts out, as we would say in football, in his own end zone. He's already in trouble when he's born. He needs a God and a Savior to help him out of it. Does that answer your question?
It does. The notion that every culture is based in a belief system helps to understand the relation between religious education and moral education. And nowadays, where schools are trying to be in a very knee-jerk fashion secular in what they offer to students, I guess what motivates my question about the distinction between religious education and moral education is underneath that is a practical question. How can that be presented, packaged, taught in a public school context in such a way that parents don't have a problem that their kids are receiving ethical education in the school system?
Well, I guess we have to agree on what morality is, what ethics is. As I have seen in our school, we have a great Asian population, and there are definitely different ways of thinking of from the West to the East, the community. There's different ways they perceive law. There's kind of like the who culture and the what culture. The West is more of a what culture. What happened? If there's a car accident, what happened? Who was driving? Where were they driving? How were they driving? Were they legal? Were they not? Or the who culture, which is more what I've seen in Africa and in Asia, is who does it affect? This car accident, does it affect the family? Was it a parent? Was it a child? Who? We don't care what, we care who. And this happens in school with we had some problems in our school with cheating. What a Westerner would describe as cheating, immoral, wrong, unethical behavior, an Asian would say, I'm helping my brother. I must help my brother. It is my job to help my brother. it would be unethical and immoral for me not to help my brother pass this English test. Now, who's right? That's a toughie.
Let's take a short musical break, and then we will continue.
Thank you.
Hello, and welcome back to Liquid Books. Our guest today is Joe Circatella, and we've just been listening to some beautiful music that Joe has brought with us today. This was Josh Groban, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. Joe, our topic today is moral education in children, and you said something earlier in our conversation which motivated me to ask two questions. I've asked the what I call the easier question, and I want to now approach the larger topic which you've raised, namely the notion of absolute versus relative morality. If I understand you rightly, you're suggesting that there is an absolute morality, and the questions that arise from that are very challenging. For example, how do we determine what is that morality? How do we reach agreement on it? How do we enact it, and so on?
So it's a big, big question that I will try to chip away at. I think we have to find some common ground on the foundational level. Is it agreed that there is value to every human life? Yes or no? Is there some type of standard justice that people can agree on? I think we have to be very careful of moral neutrality, because this slips into moral relativism, and that is the dangerous thing. Tolerance becomes tolerance of everything. Tolerance becomes a substitution for truth. That is a huge question. What do you think?
I am coming from a similar point of view, I think, as you. And so the things you're saying resonate very deeply with me. And yet, I think if one wants to shift the focus a little bit, the things you're suggesting are the basic tenets of a person of faith. A person, for example, a Christian, or someone who believes in God. And so I'm wondering if these notions of absolute morality for a God-believing person have any value without first establishing an element of faith. These are, for example, if one accepts these as absolute laws of God, it implies that it makes sense in the context of a life of believing in God. Mm-hmm. Do those things exist as absolutes without a system of faith?
Well, there's absolute truth in certain in areas. People's like, if I drop this pen, it will fall. I tell our parents, some of our parents come in and they may be atheists, agnostics, and we have 10 different religions, and we will discuss issues, because they will say, what is this thing at your school, this God thing, what is that? And I say, well, we believe that there is a creator God. There is a God. That's why it's 2 and 2, 4 in Jakarta. Yes. Is 2 and 2, 4 in Toronto? Yes. Is it 2 and 2, 4 on the moon? Yes. Why is that? Why is there order to things? Well, you know, a Rolls Royce did not just evolve. Somebody in Britain built that automobile. So it is self-evident to us that there is a supreme being. It's also self-evident to us as Christians that man is a fallen creature. And he starts, like I said, in his own end zone, and he will never be perfect. And that's okay. But when man tries to be perfect, when man uses government, like how many times have we had utopia promised to us? Nazism promised us, communism promised us, all these isms, fascisms, they're all going to legally, politically, man-made utopia, and we have got nothing but, in the 20th century, blood from one end to the other. So What is man's not going to do it, is our belief, and we rely on God, and He will set absolutes and says what is right and what is wrong, and gives us the insight on how to deal with it, knowing that we're going to fail.
What then can we say to a listener, a parent, a citizen who extends that argument to the traditional religious sphere, who says that Christianity, Islam, Judaism, etc., are also filled with blood?
There are extremes on in every religion, and it does not debunk the religion. We have extremes in political parties. It does not define. We can say that many marriages end in divorce. Is marriage wrong? That many kids end up in foster homes or orphanages. Okay, we should stop having children. No, there is the radical fringe of everything, but it does not debunk the core. It might even prove it in some arguments. But.
Another challenge that this raises is that, for example, given that there are certain absolutes, it is their manifestation in different places at different times, which still can be seen to vary. Just to take your example of gravity, if I drop my pen, it falls here. If I drop my pen in Jakarta, it falls. If I drop my pen in Toronto, it falls. But if I drop my pen on the moon, it doesn't quite fall the same way. It
falls a different way.
We are continually finding new situations, new challenges to our traditional notions of even physical reality as we expand outward in the oceans, in far-off places, in space, and so on. To what extent can, therefore, our morality be legislated once and for all, and to what extent is it a set of tools for meeting every new reality that we come across?
Well, it will never be once and for all. I read a great book last summer. I highly recommend it, called The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. He was here at CEU last April or May, and he just greatly describes the globalization and how things are and the way things are changing. But certain things don't change. It is always bad, we believe, to torture a baby. It is always bad to kill your mother-in-law. It is always bad to do certain things are always bad. I'll keep with that for now.
The question then becomes, who, by what authority, has the absolute right or ability to legislate for others what that system of beliefs and laws is? If we're talking about a world moving toward a more globalized system, which obviously we are, you know, I mean, obviously that's the reality we're over against in this generation. That's the big story that we're all coming to better and better understand and navigate. On a global level, can there be such absolutism, and in what way?
One of the surprising points Thomas Friedman made in this book was how, with globalization and with the high-speed technology, with the connectability of people, that the one world was not going to become such a one world. It was actually the opposite was happening. That little enclaves of people around the world would be able to retain their ethnicity because they could connect with home, or they didn't have to leave home to get a job. They could stay in Bangalore. They didn't have to go to Chicago. People who were displaced from Kazakhstan and they moved to Detroit or something, even though they physically moved because of the internet and because of, they could still keep their connection, their language, their culture. So instead of flattening the world and that everyone was going to become one, it's actually doing the opposite to him.
That's a wonderful image. It means that one's traditional notion of identity, which was previously fixed in space, I mean, in a per- tied to a geography of place is now something more fluid. In a globalized world, you can move around and still maintain your identity thanks to advances in technology, which make that possible for the first time. What about on the level of legal systems? You were talking earlier about who cultures versus what cultures. Does that support the idea of a relative morality?
I don't think you can legislate morality. This has been the charge, and it's probably correct charge levied against what they would call the radical right or the radical Christian right wing in the United States. I'm not sure that they are always so radical. I think that one of the big problems political now in the world, in Hungary, in the United States, is too much name-calling, too much labeling, that we can't sit down and talk and even figure out what we agree on. But you certainly cannot legislate morality. You can't make a law to legislate behavior. You must change. This is one of the things where I thought Ronald Reagan was correct. He said you cannot legislate. He was talking about abortion and things like that. He says you can't legislate this. You have to change people's hearts. And it's the same with taxes. It's the same with marriage. It's the same with education. You can't force people to do something. You can try. This is what the fascism did and the communism. You can force people to do something, but it is coerced. It is fear. Either man does moral acts as a moral agent because of duty, or he will have to be forced to do it by fear or law.
Then it comes back around to education. Education is the key, the cornerstone to a working, healthy system of morality on a level higher than the cultural level, on a world level, it seems.
Well, education is the hot button. It's the biggest. It's an incredible. Obviously, you can change whole entire cultures by. We've seen this in communism and Nazism. You can change whole cultures by getting to the youth and changing the youth. So, what do you want to tell the youth? What do you want to build them? Because you can change the generation very quickly. With the internet today, we can change fads and fashions and add words, add vocabulary in minutes, in months. The whole kind of thing has changed. The whole paradigm shift with education is I'll go back to Mr. Friedman's book. He has a whole section on education. I'm not selling that book, by the way, everyone who's listening. But I did give quite a few away. Friedman said that parents have got to get involved in their child's education. You cannot trust the schools. You cannot trust everybody to do the right thing anymore, because we've had this moral relativism for 40, 50, 60 years. You don't know. Your children are not going to the same school that you went to. It is a different world. You have got to get involved, see what books they're reading, see what they're listening to, see what they're hearing, and get involved. And people need to get serious. Our children now are bombarded with entertainment. The big complaint of students today is, of their teacher, is you're boring me. That's the big insult. How dare you in the year 2000 bore me. You must entertain me. I am here to be entertained. This is the MTV generation. This is the click it and pick it generation. You just get on the internet and everything is happening. The kids live in a different world now. They live in nanoseconds. It's incredible.
You have a great emphasis on morality in the school where you are principal in Budapest, Greater Grace International School. Do you have any personal examples from the kids in that school of people from different cultures interacting where a healthy dose of teaching about morality helped in a situation for them to reach a different paradigm and understand each other better and harmonize their behavior?
It's interesting. Our kids, we're a Christian school, but our students don't have to be Christian. We don't, if they become Christians, that's nice. If they don't, that's their choice. It's not a requirement for graduation or anything like that. But most of them come back to us within months and tell us, you know, I know it's going to sound funny, but I really miss Bible class. Now, these are not Christians. These are Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Mormons. We've got it all. But they like that every day, which doesn't happen on TV, it doesn't happen in public school, that they were talked to about these kinds of things that gave them some moral clarity and vision, gave them what I call a moral compass. Because the kids, if you don't give it to them, where is it they're going to get it? Where? Who's going to do it? A lot of parents, both parents have to work. Sadly, they have to travel so much. Sadly, you need two people to work in many economies just to make ends meet. So who's babysitting and raising the kids? The TV? Yes. The movie? Hollywood? This is scary. This is scary stuff. So who is indoctrinating our kids over and over? I have a big problem with some of this gangster rap music that our parents are oblivious that their children are listening to. Because, Andrew, in my days, if I wanted to listen to the Beach Boys, my dad could hear it through the wall, right? If I had it up too loud, it was like, Joe, turn it down. Now, parents do not have any idea what their children are listening to, because they stick their iPod into their computer, they download it, and in 3 or 4 seconds, they have 400 songs. They're walking around with their little headpieces, and they're walking around listening to some of the most evil, vile music, I guess they call it, that you can imagine. And I've bought a few of these CDs, and I have shown it to parents who have almost had a heart attack in my office when I said, your fifth grader is listening to this. You think he's studying Latin. He is not studying Latin. He is listening to this 200 times a day. Scary. Scary, and I'm glad that we have got the opportunity in schools as educators to at least show our parents and shine the light on certain things that they would never see. They are really, the way that the society is, the parents often do not have the time or even think that their kids are in danger. They're worried about sometimes what they eat. You know, they're very worried about, you know, don't eat that junk, don't go to McDonald's 14 times a week, don't do this, don't do that. But they have no idea what they're watching, and they have no idea what they're hearing, and who is forming the morality of that kid. I have a quote here by Aristotle. See, I'm so smart, Andrew. I read these. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence is not an act, but a habit. If you listen to junk, what did they tell us when you were learning computer science? Garbage in, garbage out. Scary.
Let's take another short musical break, and when we come back, I will ask you about some of the more practical aspects of how we can move forward from here in the public school system.
Hallelujah!
Andrea Bocelli with a sacred aria, Gloria to Jesus Christ. We're talking with Joe Circatella. He's a principal of Greater Grace International School in Budapest. We're talking about moral education. Joe, you're an educator. This is your life. This is your main focus. And so you have the great blessing of having your own school and educating privately. But there is a great number of kids out there in the public school system who obviously need moral education as well. How can we coherently, as a community, as a society, as a world, start to address that problem realistically?
There is no education without discipline. That's what they call it. Educational disciplines, right? Science is a discipline. Where did this word come from? And until you get discipline back into the schools and you get integrity back into the classrooms, you're going to have a problem. In our culture where we were raised, we have, it's kind of like survival of the fittest. Capitalism, you make it or break it, you sink or swim, except in education. The most important thing is education. More tax dollars go to education. There is more money poured into education. If you read Friedman's book or John Stossel's book this year about myths and lies and other things that we thought were true, John Stossel's from 2020 and ABC, and you find out that really there is a monopoly on education in the United States and in many other countries, obviously. And unless you allow students to go to whatever schools they want, why would the schools get better? Why? there's no, if you have a monopoly and you have certain students that must attend your school, it's funny, in Europe, it doesn't work that way. You have to attract students to your high schools. If you're a French-Hungarian school, you want to attract students. The more students you attract, the more money you get from the government, and to keep your program going and to keep your boat floating. But sadly, in the States, we have seen a huge increase. People vote in America with their feet. And what that means, if a restaurant isn't good, you walk out. You never go back. I do not complain at restaurants. I'm not going to give myself indigestion, but I'll never go back. Same thing with education. People are leaving the public schools en masse. I was in a county in New Jersey. I took my daughter out of school in fourth grade, and we started to homeschool her because I could not believe the level of education that was lacking there. I met 400 families that had done the same thing. There is a whole industry in the United States. There are millions of students being homeschooled. Parents don't see any alternatives. Now you have started charter schools, and the NEA and these groups are very much against anything. And why? Why? Why can't we assess teachers? Teachers, as you know, I love classical music. I'm listening to this today. I brought a song. I don't know if they played it already, Eroica by Beethoven. And this was, I began to love classical music because of Mrs. Martin in Westtown Thornbury School in Westtown, Pennsylvania, because she turned me on to Beethoven and Bach and Brahms, the three Bs. It's the teacher in the classroom. And we have teachers, it's a joke in New York City, the miscommunications, the teachers cannot even write a letter home to the parents. They put them in the Daily News. They print them, they're mocking them. We have got to clean up, we need discipline, and we need school choice. And then, that is the fertile ground, then we can talk about morality. But is it moral to make a kid go to a school just because he lives in a certain neighborhood? I think not.
Let's say that there were two suggested ways to improve the public school system. The first, teacher training, and the second, by introducing a course of study in morality. Let's take each of those cases separately. If you were to help design a teacher training program for teachers in the public school system, you had some 20, 40, 60 hours of education to give those teachers a stronger ability to create an ethical, moral environment and to transmit those values to kids in the public school system, what kinds of things might you think of teaching to those teachers? What would you want to say to public school teachers to make them change their way of doing things?
Many of them are doing a great job in spite of the system. In spite of the system, there's individual. There's a school, Hobart, is a school in, I believe, South Central LA, and there's an incredible, I forget the gentleman's name, but he's a fifth grade teacher. There's a DVD out. That's, I'm not selling these, by the way. There's a DVD out called The Hobart Shakespeareans, and it is the most incredible little one hour video on this fifth grade teacher and how he is using Shakespeare and many different avenues to bring these kids awareness and to show them where they can go. He takes them to classical music. He takes them to fine restaurants. Every year he takes them to Washington, D.C. They're in L.A., but he has raised the money on his own or with donors to show these kids the finer things. That's a big question. I had to sit down. I never thought of that, Andrew. You're asking me two tough questions here. To design a program, I agree that it's education, but the teachers have to accept it too. That there is a need, and I'm not sure that so many people or teachers may even realize there's a need. And if they don't see the need, then they don't see a solution.
In Hungary, it is mandated that teachers do periodic retraining. And one of those options for them is to learn how to organize courses in ethical education or simply to, as part of their retraining to learn how to transmit those values in their regular teaching. So in fact, technically, the possibility does exist in the Hungarian school system. The other possibility, which is already mandated, for example, here in Hungary, is to explicitly teach courses in religious, moral, and ethical education. If such a course were to be presented as a template to the Hungarian, say, Hungarian public school system, we're here in Hungary, what elements would you see as constituting a basic course for students, say elementary school students, junior high level, say, in ethical education? To what extent, for example, is it closely tied to the Christian moral code? Or to what extent is it possible to move forward in an interfaith way with such a course?
It may not have to be tied to a Christian moral code. There is right and wrong in the world. Now, we believe as Christians that moral code comes from God. The Judeo-Christian ethic, if you look on the walls of the Congress in the United States, you have great lawgivers, and Moses is one of them. It is interesting that we are taking the Ten Commandments off of the walls of the schools, and what has that done? Well, now we have schools that look like jails. They have bars on the windows. They have metal detectors at the doors. Police are walking up and down the school. I cannot imagine this. But this is what... Imagine going to school, being checked for weapons, and having bars in the windows and police outside because of the drug. This is the environment you're supposed to learn in. Ten Commandments seem pretty easy. I don't believe I'm a religious zealot, but it's pretty basic stuff. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Don't steal your neighbor's wife. You know, this is. Can we not agree on those things? I know Ted Turner called them the 10 suggestions. Okay, well, we could suggest that you don't do these things, but what are the problems in the schools today? Lying, stealing, cheating. Well, does anyone tell the kids it's not right to lie, steal, or cheat? So you tell them it's not right to lie, steal, or cheat. I've gone to many, many, many business and corporate training and educational training seminars through the years, and I'll tell you, the bottom line, I could have saved a lot of money, is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I don't know where I heard that, but it seemed pretty basic to me. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Solves a lot of problems. Learn that in kindergarten.
Let me make an invitation to you then. You are very, very busy with your school in Budapest, I know. But suppose a council of people could be put together here in Budapest from the different faiths and from different educational sectors to address this kind of issue and come up with some recommendations to present to the Hungarian school system. Would you be willing to participate in such a council?
Absolutely. And I think the Hungarians are very open to that. If that team of people could come up with some kind of curriculum and get into the schools, I think that it's very needed. We have some friends in Romania that are doing something similar. The Romanian government has seen a great need for ethical and moral training in their schools, and they've tasked, there's I believe some kind of task force there to develop that curriculum.
In fact, that's the good news here. It is a hot topic at the highest levels. The Hungarian National Core Curriculum actually now provides a framework for moral education, but no clear stipulation about how it should be taught. So this is something that is actively being explored right now. And if you wanted to be a part of a group that could make some recommendations in that regard, I think it could really make a great difference.
Yeah, it would be wonderful, and hopefully it doesn't get tied up in bureaucratic red tape, because this is something that we need yesterday. Mm-hmm. We don't have time. We are 50 years behind. Moral relativists have had their way for a long time. Radical individualism, people that this whole me generation, that let's do it, it's good for me, we turned into this consumerism. This is a sad part of coming to Hungary from the United States. I come here and I see 78 McDonald's and MTV, and I think, oh, this is the great thing. This is what we've exported. This is what our country's exported. This materialism, it's too much. Everybody's full of stuff. I it's a quick little story. I met with an exterminator once, I think, and then I said, how did you kill these bugs? You know, there was just some bugs they couldn't kill. They couldn't stop. They were unbelievable. He said, we fed them. What'd you feed them? Nothing. What do you mean you fed them nothing? We fed them a lot of food that has no nutrition, and they starved to death with full stomachs. So, yeah, I would love to be in any group. I'll make time. I don't believe when people say I don't have time. I figure I have 168 hours a week. Everybody else does, too. If it's important, we make the time.
Fantastic. Joe, this has been a really inspiring conversation for me, and I hope for our listeners as well. And we can make this an open invitation to anyone who cares to be involved with these subjects. We will provide on our website a way to contact you, if that's all right. Yeah. And let's take this conversation as a starting point then, and see, you know, let's meet again here in this forum sometime from now and see where, if we can make some progress. That's on great. These things.
Joe, thank you. I appreciate being here and all that you're doing here in Hungary for the years and years now, really.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us. And from all of us here at Liquid Books, from our engineer Naji, and for myself, have a great night. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.